Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. How are we going to make Seattle a more affordable place to rent a home? That's where we begin this hour. There is an idea to cut down on the number of rentals that go to people who are visiting us. You know, more and more owners are renting out their rooms and homes on platforms like Airbnb and VRBO, renting space to visitors. Those are homes that are not on our local rental market, and usually less supply means higher prices. I talked to two people about this new idea. Michelle Aquavella owns vacation properties in Seattle. Also, Rebecca Saldana advocates for affordable housing with a group called Puget Sound Sage. Rebecca likes the idea of limiting Airbnb-type rentals.
As we're growing, what we're asking is, you know, who gets to live here? Who gets to benefit from economic opportunity of a thriving city? And our concern is that if we don't look at the increase of short-term rentals through on-demand giants like Airbnb, that we could be seeing what's happening in San Francisco, which is that we actually are seeing people pushed out and displaced for conversions to short-term rentals.
Michelle, you own and manage short-term rental properties in Seattle. First, do you accept that these kind of short-term rentals do make it more expensive for renters who live here?
Well, to come at it in kind of a different angle, what I would agree that we have seen a great increase in the number of vacation rentals over the last couple of years. And this is because Airbnb has become wildly popular. We've started to hear it mentioned on TV shows. We've got billboards off the Ballard Bridge. And people get excited about this idea. And so we've seen a huge influx of new inventory into the vacation rental market here in Seattle. However, the cost-benefit analysis of whether or not to do a vacation rental versus a long-term unfurnished rental has really evened out to the point where we used to be able to say as a property management company, you're going to make this much more as a vacation rental versus long-term unfurnished. And today that's just not true anymore. So what I propose is that we're going to see supply and demand take care of this issue, but there are so many more vacation rentals in the market these days that even my own company, and we very closely monitor our occupancy rates and do a lot of different marketing techniques to increase those, we're being hit pretty significantly and seeing lower occupancy rates and lower rental rates because of that.
Okay, so you're seeing more supply coming onto the market, Airbnb's getting popular, you think the market will take care of this on its own. I want to know, Michelle, how would this new proposed Seattle rule affect you?
Oh, so this regulation, if implemented as written by Tim Burgess's office, would put my business out of business. And this is a business that I have put my blood, sweat, and tears into, literally, over the last 13 years when I started it. And I'm not the only vacation rental property manager, and we employ people. We're looking at a loss of over 100 jobs. To what Tim Burgess's office is estimating, and I think it's even a high estimate, that there would be 300 housing units added to the long-term rental inventory. This is not something that I find acceptable as a Seattle resident. Airbnb got in way before us and basically dictated to the city council what they would like to see happen, and I am a single mother. I'm a small business owner. Been doing this for 13 years. And I would really like to stay in business the way that this is written. We would not be able to. We would have to shutter.
Rebecca, as Michelle said, these renters are basically local small businesses. Wouldn't this hurt them? And really, who it would help is big hotel companies?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the things that is important is that we're talking about, you know, how do we actually look at the impact of short-term rentals on the market? And one of the things is that we don't have clear data. I mean, the data that we are using would say that only 80% of all hosts will be unaffected by Burgess's proposal. And so there is still an opportunity for people, especially individuals, to be able to have this be supplemental to their income and be able to stay. But our concern is that the way that it's set right now is that it doesn't take into account the fact that a lot of de facto commercial property owners and out-of-state investors are basically running de facto hotels through
their Airbnb. Would the legislation then only crack down on big companies or only out-of-city or out-of-state companies?
No, but that is the majority of where the growth is, and that's the part that we're concerned. We're not concerned about, you know, the individual small business, and in most parts, I think that there's ways to work to address that concern. What we are seeing is that Michelle's company, for instance, actually uses their name, has their own website, is following guidelines and regulations. But what we're seeing as happening through platforms is that we have people using one name, Derek or Jane, and having multiple listings. And what, in fact, they're doing is trying to skirt the regulations that we do have on lodging that hotel operators do have to operate by.
They pretend to be people who just, hey, I'm just sharing my home, but they're actually companies.
Exactly.
Okay, Rebecca, wouldn't the city make a much bigger, though, more significant dent in rental costs by adding housing, letting developers build more units, allowing more mother-in-law apartments, more little boutique hotels outside of downtown in the neighborhoods where these tourists or visitors want to stay, rather than cracking down on people like Michelle's private property rights?
Well, I'm the executive director of Puget Sound Sage, and actually our core mission is to make sure that we are building a city and growing a city that everyone can be part of. So I think it's very important that as we have these on-demand platforms from Uber to Airbnb, that we're making sure that we're updating our city regulations and policies to make sure that they are actually contributing and being high-standard companies that can make a profit and are not actually undermining the values and the goals of our city to grow inclusively and affordably for everyone.
Michelle, how do you think the city of Seattle should, if at all, help rent become more affordable?
Well, I think for start, by adding an estimated 300 rental units, we're really just a drop in the bucket when you go after the vacation rental industry. I have been watching closely the backyard cottage issue and relaxing some of the rules around adding backyard cottages. And that's where I think we've run out of space, and so we have to become more dense. And that's where I think we should really be focusing our attention, is how do we add more capacity to the city by adding density.
That is Michelle Acquavella, owner of Sea to Sky Rentals, and Rebecca Saldana, executive director of Puget Sound Sage, talking about this idea that's being batted around now in the Seattle City Council, the possibility of cutting down on the number of rentals that go out to visitors on platforms like Airbnb and VRBO. We're going to keep on covering how the city is tackling affordable housing right here on KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. Monday marks the 72nd anniversary of the D-Day invasion, the day U.S. troops stormed the beaches of Normandy, France, the beginning of the end of World War II. Victims of that battle and others are buried at the American cemetery that overlooks Normandy's Omaha Beach. Reporter Bobby O'Brien says a younger generation is making sure those service members, are not forgotten.
Private Leo Chalcraft is among the 9,387 military dead buried at the American Cemetery in Normandy. He had green eyes, brown hair, and was killed in action just 6 days after his 19th birthday.
He was so young, and I feel he didn't get to experience a lot of his life.
17-year-old Connor Ross is studying military documents, online archives, and personal mementos to learn more about Leo. Her research has brought her so close that she now refers to the young soldier only by his first name.
Leo was part of the 66th Infantry Division. They had a patch on their shoulders, the division patch, and it was a Black Panther. And I bought one of the patches on Amazon so that way I could have it.
Ross is part of the Silent Hero Project, run by the National History Day program. High school students and teachers from around the country research a soldier, sailor, or airman from their home state who is buried in Normandy. Then they plan to travel there later this month to deliver eulogies at the service members' gravesites. Ross and her Largo High School history teacher, Deborah Pettingill, chose Chalcraft as their silent hero because he lived nearby in St. Petersburg. Pettingill found his younger brother living just about an hour's drive north.
I stumbled across a photograph from a car dealership in Inverness of an older couple with their new car and said, "Congratulations to Albert and Charlotte Chalcraft." I'm thinking, now how many Albert and Charlotte Chalcrafts can there be?
Leo Chalcraft's legacy is now kept by his brother Albert and his wife Charlotte.
When Mom Chalcraft passed away, that's when I found out about Leo. The name was never spoken. I had to go through her papers, and that's when I found the items. We have the flag. We have his wallet.
Fragments from the end of Leo's life. The beginning was much like other families during the Great Depression. Albert Chalcraft said Leo, who was 4 years older, dropped out of school before seventh grade to work at a gas station fixing cars.
Leo was older than I was, so he ran around, as they call it, run around back then. Now they call it hanging out. With older people, and I didn't see him that much.
Leo was drafted into the Army at age 18, and there are a few documents to give insight into his life, but for a handful of letters mailed home. Written in luxurious longhand, he asks about his brothers, says he's sending home $20 a month, and asks his mother to send him candy and cookies. She never got a chance. His troop ship, the Leopoldville, was torpedoed off the coast of France on Christmas Eve, 1944.
He shouldn't have died that day.
Again, history teacher Deborah Pettingill.
There was really no reason for him to have died that day if it were not for the mistakes that were made.
The troop ship was 5 miles off the French coast when it was attacked. It took 2.5 hours to sink and could have been towed ashore, but survivors said that rescue vessels were slow to respond. More than 750 soldiers died, among them Leo Chalcraft. His final resting place is with his infantry buddies at the American Cemetery in Normandy. That's where Connor Ross plans to be later this month to deliver a eulogy for him.
Somehow, Leo, I hope you know that everyone remembers you. You have not been forgotten. For the rest of her life, Christmas reminded your mother of you. Your niece, Albert's daughter, was close to your mother and knew all about you. And now I know you, and I'll never forget you.
I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
Our stories on the military and veterans are part of the American Homefront Project. It's a national collaboration with NPR and KUOW and WUNC in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, and KPCC in Los Angeles. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. A news note here, a Seattle University dean is off the job. Jody Kelly, dean of the school's Humanities College. Some students have accused her of racism, and they've wanted her to resign as part of their demands for Seattle U to be more culturally inclusive. If you haven't heard our coverage of this, go to KUOW.org. Seattle University has been defending Kelly, but now they have put her on administrative leave as the university investigates the students' complaints. Dean Kelly, we'd like to hear your side of the story. What do you think of the students' claims that you and the school's curriculum and hiring practices are racist and hostile to minority students? What do you think of the way these students are approaching their education? We hope to interview Dean Jody Kelly, and in any case, we will keep on covering this. What is happening with our schools, our students, our culture? Continue to join us here on KUOW Seattle and online at KUOW.org. Before Suzanne Adams moved to Seattle, she was a police chief in Colorado, where she didn't feel like she could be herself in her job or her life.
We would have made very good spies for America. We hid this part of our life and nobody ever found out.
We hid this part of our life. When Suzanne says we, she's talking about herself and other transgender people. She describes her time as a police chief in Colorado as being in her role as a man. Well, now she's in Seattle, and she's been working with the Seattle Police Department, training officers on how to interact with transgender people. She helped SPD write new policy that includes guidelines for physical searches and for when to use the pronouns he or she. Adams told us she got involved with SPD after talking with Seattle's former police chief, Norm Stamper.
So he was talking with me, and I was talking with him, and he said something like, "Do I know you?" Well, I knew Norm because when I was the chief of police from a smaller town in Colorado, he was assistant chief of police in San Diego, and we'd met at a convention.
You had met him when in your role as
a
male?
In my role as a male, yeah, as a chief of police. And here it is a dozen years later, and he's talking to me in one of his sponsored, it was SPD-sponsored gathering, and then he met me as Suzanne, and he liked that. He thought that was pretty good, and he says, "We can use you." And then and from there, he got me involved in various aspects of community policing involving police department and the LGBTQ community.
How do you train Seattle officers?
We told them how to confront and how to contact. We'd sit two chairs down and say, "This is the front seat and the passenger seat of a car. Here's how you approach it. And here's how you diffuse an issue with a trans person." A trans person, back then, was scared to death. Their job probably didn't know about it. Many times the family didn't know about it. Guy's got the weekend off. Mom's and the kids are off at grandma's house or something for the weekend. And he goes and he hits the gay clubs or the bars and he dresses up, drives his car, and he gets stopped and pulled over. "Oh, my God, I don't want anybody to know." I said, so we told the police officers, they're going to be scared. So the first thing you've got to do is you've got to diffuse the situation. You're going to notice probably right off that this doesn't look like a natural female. And tell them why you're stopping them. Tell them what's going on. Even if it's, "You're driving a little erratic, I think you're driving drunk. And I need to check things out. Don't worry about it. We're not putting you on the front page of the newspaper. Diffuse it." And that's what we taught these officers. It was amazing.
What do officers most not get about what you're trying to tell them?
"What do we call you?
What do we call you?
What do we call you?" And that's addressed in the cell protocol now. You address the person how they're addressed. Okay, they look female, but so what do I do? And we said, ask the person how they want to be addressed. Do you want to be addressed as a male or a female? Do you want to be addressed as a he or a she? Ask them right off. That's a great diffusing question. The officer's job going to be easier, and the transgender person's going to relax a little bit. Nobody's really relaxed when they're stopped by a cop.
Do officers understand that, or do some of them tell you, "Hey, it's not my job to be politically correct. It's my job to describe this person physically"?
I saw that look on some officer's face. I knew what they were thinking. I'd been a cop. I'm sure some of them might have thought that. For the most part, most of them really wanted to get it. These were recruits. These are people that wanted to be successful as a cop. And they do pretty good screening for police officers. They don't get the guy that wants to be the big dick out there and busting people, although some of them get through and they hide behind the badge. I know I was in the police department. I saw some of those. We called them John Wayne types. Not to make a bad name for John Wayne, but it was the best analogy we could do.
What do you say to that John Wayne officer who's not getting what you're trying to put across? The officer just says, "Hey, leave the political correctness to somebody else."
Hopefully you don't have any. And I've used that as an example. I say, you know, if you get aggressive and you say, "Well, you look like a he to me," and things like that, I said, all you're going to do is piss that person off. Is that your job? No. I said, your job is to diffuse the situation and to make it as easy as possible. And then I always appeal to the thing. I said, if anything else happens outside of the ordinary, you're going to spend 2 hours doing the paperwork. And that usually gets their attention because they realize
that's the motivator.
That, yeah, the motivator is you're going to have to work harder if you're going to cause a problem. And I said, and you're the cop. It's like you're the one in charge. Be the one in charge and do it right.
We've talked about a lot of tactics.
Yes.
What's your message to officers in these transgender training sessions? What do you want them to, how do you want them to think differently after your session?
Mostly you don't need to change them. You need to have them be aware, to treat people with dignity and respect. And I don't care if it's trans, if they're black, if they're Filipino, if they're a white male, for crying out loud. Treat people with respect. And that's what Seattle Police has always taught their officers.
But you know the Seattle Police Department has gotten in trouble for the way it treats minority groups, biased policing, excessive force. How do you think Seattle Police do with transgender community?
I do know that they had a problem with some of the other communities. It's treating people with respect, generally. And that's what I think that's hopefully what the Department of Justice is laying down rules now for the Seattle Police Department to follow. They intervened on because of some of these other issues. But I am going to answer your question, how they've handled the trans people in the past. Very well. They haven't had many confrontations. There are stories out there, but it's nothing horrible that I've heard.
You have said that your work with Seattle Police Department is a way to give back to Seattle. Why did you feel you needed to give something back to Seattle?
Seattle gave me the opportunity to live as Suzanne. I mean, it's like pay it forward. I so much appreciated being able to live in Seattle and live my life as Suzanne. Free, not being persecuted, being able to help others. Seattle just has this atmosphere that it offers people to be themselves. It's a diverse community. How can I repay Seattle for doing that? I'll do what I can. I was a former police officer. I'll work with the police department. We'll make it better for everybody.
That is Suzanne Adams, and she helps the Seattle Police Department write its new policy to serve the trans community. And she also chairs the Seattle Police Department's LGBTQ Community Advisory Board. Now you're going to meet somebody with a very different take on gender. As part of her series, Art of Our City, KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman introduces you to a local performer who says she takes your expectations, tosses them in a mason jar, shakes it up, and opens the lid.
Cher Donna. That name's an homage to performance icons Cher and Madonna. The look? Well, picture Marie Antoinette after an encounter with a drunken makeup artist. Disheveled blonde bouffant, glittery blue eyeshadow, oversized purple lips.
It's been a journey for me to figure out what my femininity is.
That's Cher Donna's creator, Jody Keener. An openly queer woman, Keener was in an androgynous phase 7 years ago when she first started to perform as the drag queen Cher Donna.
That year one was like a little bit of lip gloss, barely some eyeshadow. It was really, really toned down.
Now careening around a Seattle stage, she's like a juiced-up Lucille Ball. Cher Donna stands 6'2" in her spiked heels with a canopy of false eyelashes. At a time when the national political conversation is focused on gender identity, Keener uses her drag alter ego to make people think about their shared humanity.
There's so many things that are problems, gender, women's rights, racism, that are all literally about people making assumptions based on first look. Just looks.
It's hard to look at Cher Donna and not think about who she is and who we are. From Capitol Hill, that's The Art of Our City. I'm Marcy Silman.
And I highly recommend that you watch Jody Keener transform into Cher Donna at our website, KUOW.org. You can see her in person tonight and through the weekend at Velocity Founders Theater on Capitol Hill. And you'll find all of Marcy's art stories on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr. Just look for the hashtag Art of Our City. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke with this news update. Paul Ryan now says he will vote for Donald Trump. Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, he's a leader of the Republican Party, so his split with Trump has been a big deal to watch. How can we have a Republican Party split between its leaders and its presidential nominee? Well, today, Ryan has a column. It's just been released on the website of his hometown Wisconsin newspaper, The Gazette, in Janesville, Wisconsin. And he says that he and Trump don't agree on everything, but that he's been talking with Trump about Ryan's idea of a Republican agenda. He says, quote, through these conversations, I feel confident He would help us turn the ideas in this agenda into laws to help improve people's lives. That's why I'll be voting for him this fall. And Paul Ryan goes on to say, a Clinton White House would mean 4 more years of liberal cronyism and a government more out for itself than the people it serves. That's something we will be hearing more about as we analyze that coming up through the afternoon here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. A local multimillionaire has begun a spat with NASA over asteroids. Former Microsoftie Nathan Myhrvold says NASA scientists don't know as much as they think they do about so-called near-Earth objects, the asteroids that fly around close to our planet, asteroids that could hit the Earth, and, you know, end humanity. The aerospace and science editor at GeekWire, Alan Boyle, told Jeannie Yandel that Myhrvold crunched the data from NASA's asteroid team and he could not replicate their conclusions.
And so he raised questions about that. He said, I don't see how you can come up with these measurements. Instead of having a 10% margin of error, I'm getting a 300% margin of error. This doesn't make sense. And so the NASA team came back and said, you're the one who's not making sense. We looked at the way that you did it, and we're finding some basic math errors. We're finding confusions between radius and diameter. So why did you do this?
We might have listeners right now who are hearing this and thinking, okay, some guy said NASA was wrong. But Nathan Myhrvold is not just some guy. Who is Nathan Myhrvold?
Yeah. This is a case of some guy standing up in the back of the room and saying, I don't think you're adding this up right, Mr. NASA. But in this case, the guy has $650 million for a net worth. Nathan Myhrvold is well known in the tech community. He was the chief technology officer at Microsoft in the very beginning years. He was kind of a gadfly for Bill Gates. And then he went on to found a company called Intellectual Ventures. Some people say that it's a patent trolling company, but it has a lot of spinoffs in a wide range of fields from nuclear power to antennas for picking up signals from space. And so he's developed a lot of cred in other fields, and including dinosaurs, that he raised some questions about dinosaur growth rates in an earlier back and forth. And so this is a case where he was asked to invest in an asteroid project, and he looked at it, and he just couldn't make sense out of the data, and he thought he'd write a 110-page paper about it.
What do we actually know? I know that Nathan Myhrvold doesn't agree with NASA in terms of how many there are, but what do we know and what do we not know about near-Earth asteroids?
So far, we haven't found an asteroid that is for sure coming in Earth's direction and has a chance of just destroying civilization as we know it. There are some asteroids over the next century or so that could have a chance of colliding and being a really bad day for New York or Seattle, for that matter. But we don't know the orbital path with enough precision to say for sure, man, we got to do something about this. And so that's what the state of the debate is, that they have had a survey that looks at asteroids as wide as a kilometer that could really destroy civilization. And they feel like they have a pretty good handle on those. But then you have to work your way down. Even an asteroid that's, say, 100 meters across, if it's coming at us in just the wrong way, is a really bad day. And so those are the kinds of asteroids that people are really concerned about and that they are trying to figure out what the population is, how many do we know about. There are even some calculations you can do to say, okay, even though we haven't found all the asteroids, we think that there are these many out there, and it's generally in the tens of thousands. And when you go lower to something that could you know, might pose a problem, you can get up to a million asteroids out there that need to be characterized.
What has NASA's response been to Nathan Myhrvold's conclusions? They clearly don't agree with him,
right.
But what are they saying about what he did wrong?
Well, that's what makes this case a little unusual, is that NASA went to the trouble of issuing a statement saying, we stand by our results. We see that there are some basic errors that are in Nathan Myhrvold's results, and this paper should have gone through peer review before it was talked about in the world. That the New York Times wrote an article about the same time I wrote an article for GeekWire about it. NASA seemed to be a little more concerned about the New York Times than about GeekWire. I don't understand why that's the case, but that's why NASA came out with this statement, which is unusual to kind of diss somebody so publicly about it. But it's not the end that Nathan Myhrvold is saying that he may be coming out with some more information about this. So it's a little bit of a stay tuned scenario right now.
It can be fun to talk about the fact that Nathan Myhrvold has kind of picked an argument with NASA, right?
Yeah,
there's
the
spat happening.
Spat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's public, a public asteroid spat. But I mean, beyond that, what does that mean for science and scientific research and how it happens?
Well, I think there are two answers to that. One is that the same team that was behind this NEOWISE study is proposing another mission to look for asteroids more intensely, called NEOCAM. And they're up in a competition for $450 million. And so if there's an issue over how NEOWISE was done, there's a concern about what NASA is going to do with this big project that they are going to award. And NEOWISE isn't the only one applying for this money. There are other great missions out there as well. And so there are some real implications for how the NEOWISE data is judged. And then the second thing is a wider concern about reproducibility of scientific results. We're seeing this a lot in biomedicine, where you have a study that says that coffee causes heart disease or maybe doesn't cause heart disease. And so you have to get to the data. And in many fields, scientists are finding that they need to learn more about how statistical analysis is correctly done in order to come up with useful information that affects you in your everyday life, not just when you're looking for a killer asteroid.
We've been talking a lot about what we know and what we don't know about near-Earth objects, about asteroids that might be big enough to cause damage to the planet. Really, though, how worried should we be about killer asteroids? How much of a concern should this be for us?
It's one of those events, they call it a low probability, high impact event. And so the chances of being killed in a bus accident are higher than being killed by an asteroid. And Nathan referred to this in some of the testimony that he gave some years back, where he said it's like, you know, it's like this issue with the bus accident, but in this case, the whole world is riding the same bus. And so it's not something where you wake up and the first thing that you worry about is whether an asteroid is going to hit you, but it's something where you want to make sure that you're on top of it. And one of these days, it might just save your life.
Alan Boyle is the aerospace and science editor for GeekWire, putting it all in perspective for you there. And if you'd like to geek out on this data yourself, maybe you can outthink NASA and Nathan Myhrvold. Who knows? We're going to tweet out a link right now to Myhrvold's paper on killer asteroids and NASA's response to it. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Now, speaking of the things that fly, we were just getting word that an Air Force Thunderbird plane has crashed in Colorado Springs. The Air Force says the pilot ejected, and we don't know about that pilot's condition. This was part of a flyover for the Air Force Academy commencement attended by President Obama, and the president was at the graduation site at the time of the crash, taking photos with attendees before coming back to D.C., and we will get details and pass them on to you as we learn them here at KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. So you're walking down the street, and you see one of those people with a clipboard. Uh-oh. They're going to tell me about their virtuous cause, their very well-meaning cause. What do you talk to them? Do you keep on walking? And have you ever wondered what it's like to be that person doing the ask all day, every day? Reporter Raja Shah met up with a canvasser named Joanna Holden on a San Francisco street corner to find out what it's like to do her job.
Joanna's day starts at 10:15 a.m. She'll split it into four quarters, and by 5 o'clock, she needs to make $185, which covers her salary and the organization's programs.
This is a really solid corner. I've worked here many a time.
We're in an upscale neighborhood in San Francisco. $8 milkshakes, artisanal cheese shop, that kind of thing.
Hey, sister, come fight racism with me.
The crowd around here is mostly white, mostly in their 30s and 40s. A lot of people are headed to work on the train that stops here every few minutes. You're going to hear that train a lot.
That sounds loud.
The train is not so good for my recording, but it can be great for Joanna's work because every few minutes, another one arrives and releases a new wave of foot traffic, potential marks.
Hey there. Want to talk about hip-hop and social justice?
Joanna works for an organization called Hip Hop for Change, which is all about using music as a force for social justice. The money she's hoping to raise will go towards running workshops for kids from poor and marginalized backgrounds. And here's obstacle number one. The people she's asking for that money can't necessarily relate.
These neighborhoods are very idyllic, very pristine, very beautiful. So we kind of bring a slice of that reality to them. Hello, excellent human beings. Talk with me about fighting racism. 60 seconds.
Joanna's rooted in the middle of the sidewalk. The train pulls in. And as this blob of people approaches us, she starts picking out specific faces in the crowd.
Hello, fantastic humans with dogs. Let's use feminist hip-hop to fight racism. 60 seconds.
Some people politely decline.
Talk with me about ending racism.
No, thank you.
Okay.
Others walk by in total silence. This guy's on his cell phone.
Call them back. We're fighting racism.
This lady's pushing a stroller.
60 seconds. Babies are into it.
And then this guy.
Hi. Talk with me about fighting racism. 60 seconds.
I work in this neighborhood.
Oh, you've talked to us before?
No, I haven't.
Lucky day?
No. Mm. Nothing's. But just remember me, because in the future, not a participator.
Well, he used the actual phrase, I'm not a participator. Hey, sister, come dismantle racism with a local activist. 60 seconds.
60.
Yeah.
59.
I'm Joanna. What's your name?
A lot of people don't last in this job. They work for big corporate canvassing organizations, sometimes just for a day or a week. But Hip Hop for Change is a smaller organization. And this is Joanna's full-time job. She gets paid $15 an hour, the organization has a healthcare plan, and she really cares about the cause.
I know it's a little awkward to stand out here and ask for money on the street, but I do it because it's important, because these issues personally affect me as like a trans woman, you know.
So Joanna's a transgender woman. She uses the pronoun she, and she wears dresses while she works, for a reason.
I definitely think about how I'm going to dress in a way that will make me feel comfortable with how I'm being read. Because, yeah, you know.
So her gender is one reason she's really aware of how people respond to her. Her race is another. Unlike most of her coworkers, she's white. And she knows that they deal with comments and harassment that she'll never hear. That sense of injustice is what motivated her to apply to Hip Hop for Change in the first place, even though she knew she might not be a good fit.
I'm like, look, if you would rather hire person who's actually from the Bay Area hip-hop community, you should do that. But I really think my perspective would be important. And they were like, yeah, let's have you. We want you out there on the street talking about your experiences because they're worth it. Hey, sister, talk to me about fighting racism with feminist hip-hop. 60 seconds.
After a couple polite rejections and a bunch more blank stares, the blob yields an individual.
I'm Joanna. What's your name?
Hi, Bailey.
Hey, Bailey.
Hey.
So I work for Hip Hop for Change.
Joanna goes into her pitch, a one-minute explanation of Hip Hop for Change's programs.
We created an education program, the MC, that's taught over 1,500 kids self-love and self-expression through hip hop. So even a little trans girl can rap about liberation.
And then pops the question.
For funding, we do need all your damn money. I challenge you to do $50.
I can't do $50.
What can you do?
I'm also poor. Do you have information?
And Joanna is prepared for situations just like this.
Say, for example, someone's like, this is an awesome program, but I can't donate. I'm totally broke. It's like, first you acknowledge, you're like, yeah, don't worry about it. Just do as generously as you can.
This is step one of what's called a response cycle.
So yeah, do as uncomfortably as you can. Where are you from?
Missouri originally.
So you know about some racial injustice?
Yeah, I do.
Step two, get them to say they care.
This is such an important issue and you want to leave the Bay Area a better place than how you found it.
Yeah, sure.
Step three.
Hit them with some really intense fact.
Power facts.
Something you may not know is that 30% of kids in Oakland have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Step four, come back to the ask.
So, what's the most you can do? I know it's a little bit uncomfortable, but we're doing something no other organization is doing. Could you do
$20? Yeah, I can do $20.
Thank you.
Start to finish, 4.5 minutes.
Hey, talk to me about fighting racism. 60 seconds.
Next time.
Okay.
Of the hundreds of people she calls out to on any given day, about 25 or 30 will stop to talk. And about half of those will donate. So hitting her quota is essentially a numbers game.
Hey, talk to me about fighting racism.
At 3:15, she gets her big fish.
That guy did a monthly. Yeah, that guy who didn't want to get recorded did an $18 monthly.
Hip Hop for Change raises most of its budget this way. And Joanna's one of their top fundraisers. Today was a good day. She yelled out her pitch more than 200 times. I counted. 18 people gave her money. And she made her quota, $185 and then some. But she doesn't call it a day. She's a believer, and she keeps right on pitching.
Hey, talk to me about fighting racism.
Nope.
Okay.
Talk to me about fighting racism.
I am loving it.
Loving it. That's Raja Shah reporting that story. And, you know, you can hear a longer version of the story on an entertaining podcast that Casey Miner does. The podcast is called The Specialist. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. A medical examiner today reports that Prince died of an accidental overdose of fentanyl. We're going to be talking more about this this afternoon. You know, fentanyl is this synthetic opioid that is far more potent than heroin is. And we know that Prince had terrible hip pain. He had hip surgery. Prince was found dead in April in Minnesota at his Paisley Park mansion, 57 years old. This afternoon, NPR's Robert Siegel is going to help you learn what fentanyl is and how its illicit use has led to a growing number of overdoses. That's part of All Things Considered this afternoon on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Local filmmaker Sandy Siafi has spent most of her career telling stories in two dimensions on a movie screen. Well, then she had her first real experience with virtual reality. It was a piece called Project Syria. Sandy put on a virtual reality headset, and all of a sudden she found herself in the city of Aleppo, standing on a street corner, talking to a little girl.
You are relatively weightless in the space, but all of the elements move with you. So if I turn around behind me, there's a scene behind me. And then the use of sound when a bomb goes off and the feeling of dust going around your body changes your own sensation of losing the girl. You can't find her. The little girl's missing. And when you watch other people experience Project Syria, it really impacts you because you notice the common humanity. Every time other people hit the same moment in the piece, they all desperately search for the girl.
Sandy Siafi has put together a virtual reality event at the Seattle International Film Festival called SIFX. She told Ross Reynolds that she's building on someone else's work, a UW engineering professor named Tom Furness.
Because his urges are that sweet spot of the mixture of what tech can do and what it means for people, he's been involved in many projects, some of which have medical implications. And some of those are about things like getting over phobias. And he was involved in a project, I don't recall the title, but it was about fear of spiders. And in essence, if you can live it in a way that's virtual and yet, believe me, feels very real, you can actually repattern.
And I experienced that. And you see the spider kind of there coming toward you, but you still know it's not real. But it's a way, I guess, of desensitizing yourself to this extreme fear you have.
The sort of tricky cousin of virtual reality is augmented reality. You're placing things in a field of vision that includes your regular life, or IRL, in real life.
So, for example, we're sitting here in the studio and I'm talking to you, but if I'm seeing an augmented reality version of it, maybe there's someone standing next to you who's not really there.
Precisely. Or as, you know, the Space Needle did this very fun thing recently where they figured out a way to create these decals. When you're up on the top, you can hold up your cell phone and then you go to take a picture of someone and a augmented reality Space Needle is right next to them.
We've gone through many iterations of technology. It doesn't always work out. I'm thinking Google Glass was going to be the next thing, or going back even further to an era that you might also remember, quadraphonic sound. We're going to have four speakers. Everybody's going to have four speakers. And then for one reason or another, it doesn't work out. We're very early in this. What do you think the chances are of this being actually a storytelling mode in the future versus something that, oh, that was interesting, and then it petered out?
There are so many minds and so many people betting. They're betting either because they care about the money or they're betting because they care about the gaming. I'll say that in my world, I'm betting that it's going to matter, and it's going to matter tremendously, because it's not about the headset, it's not about the technology, and it's not about the money. It's about something far more profound. And you know it when you experience it. When you take the headset off and you're crying uncontrollably, and, you know, I don't cry in public that easily. This technology ranges from, you know, helping people deal with PTSD, creating empathy for stories around the world, but also immense amounts of delight and the possibility of all kinds of joy and pleasure.
Some people won't make it down to SIFX. What's your advice for them if they're intrigued by what you described? How can they experience virtual reality or some of these things outside the context of the festival?
Well, first, we're going to put quite a bit of the material that we have developed for this festival just up online for people to view. We will be directing people from our website to all of the apps where this work lives. And the other thing is that there's a $250 camera called a Ricoh Theta. And there are four or five other companies that have now come out with this. Very easy to use. It shoots the world in 360 degrees as either stills or video. And you can just hook it up to your cell phone so that you can see it. And it, for me, as a way in, I just started playing with it so that I, as a filmmaker, could say, how do I see a scene differently than the way I used to frame it when everything is in the frame? Now what? If you're just wanting to film your kid's birthday party, shooting it in 360, honestly, is kind of a blast. I mean, later, you look back and, you know, sure, there's the table with the presents and the cake, but it's really fun when you can look behind you at your, you know, half-built kitchen and the reality of your life at the time. I think that's a more complete and honest way to record reality on a photograph.
Seattle filmmaker and video artist Sandy Siafi has curated this virtual reality festival, part of Seattle International Film Festival. It's called SIFX, and it opens today. Runs today, June 2nd through June 5th. You've been listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.